This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Give a very warm welcome to our fantastic panel this morning, Tom Cheshire, Ed Gillespie, David Reynolds and Adrian Phillips.
Hello everyone, can you hear me? Is this on? That's on now, you can hear me. Thank you very much for joining us. I know Andy Murray's currently playing, so you're doing very well to come and join us here. Thank you for that. As Zoe said, we're talking today about slow travel. We'll talk about what slow travel means. It may be that some people aren't entirely clear, and there is quite a broad definition. I think it may very well be that all our panellists have a different view on what slow travel is. My name's Adrian Phillips. I'm the managing director of a company called Bratt Travel Guides, and we do guidebooks to places around the world, but we also have a slow travel series, which I think is why I've been invited to chair this. But with me are three authors of travel literature, travel narratives about journeys they've taken. I will start with David Reynolds, who is actually one of the founders of Bloomsbury Publishing. And he's written a couple of books. He started off as a sub-editor and then wrote a book called Swan River, which was very well acclaimed and I think got the Penn, was shortlisted for the Penn Ackerley Autobiography Award. And his latest book, Slow Road to Brownsville, is about a journey along Route 83 from Canada right the way down through the heart of the States to the Mexican border. We have Ed Gillespie, who was originally a marine biologist and then became an environmental campaigner, set up and co-founded a site called Futera.co.uk and advises businesses on sustainable ways of working. And his book, we have here, Only Planet, was about a journey circumnavigating the planet without flying at any stage. And finally, we have Tom Cheshire, who has been working for The Times since 97.
Yes.
Long time on the travel desk at The Times. Traveled to well over 100 countries, I suspect, on assignment. And this is his fifth book. Tom wrote To Hull and Back, which was about going to the less salubrious places within the UK. He actually wrote a book for Bratt called A Tourist in the Arab Spring, about being the first Westerner to go and travel through the countries in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. His book here, Gate Crashing Paradise, is about a trip around the Maldives to some of the areas that perhaps people won't normally associate with the Maldives, well beyond the glitzy resorts. As I say, we'll get on to the actual thoughts about what slow travel means and how we can try and embrace a more sustainable way of traveling. But let's just start with how you came to write the books that you've written. David, yours is slightly different in the sense you have a personal connection, a personal history with the region you started in, didn't you?
Yes, that's right. My grandfather lived in... Can you hear me all right? Okay. My grandfather lived in this tiny place in northern Manitoba called Swan River. He died before I was born, but none of my relations would ever speak about him, so I felt I should find out about him. And I went there in 1999... And that's one thing. And then, and I wrote a book about that, a separate issue. But while I was there on another occasion, I was driving with a local elderly man west towards Saskatchewan. And this guy stuck his thumb over his shoulder. I was driving and he was in the passenger seat. Actually, it's that way around in America. He was over there. He stuck his thumb over his shoulder and said, "That road goes to Mexico." And we were halfway up Canada, 350 miles north of the Canadian-US border. And I thought I'd misheard, and I ran it through my head, and I said, "What did you say?" And he said, "That road goes to Mexico." And then he told me it does, and it starts in Swan River for curious reasons. And one two-lane road goes 2,271 miles south from Swan River in Manitoba to Brownsville, Texas, which is on the border of Mexico, right on the Gulf of Mexico. And that got me thinking, and that's why I ended up driving down it and writing about it. And it particularly fascinated me because there's a lot of Wild West and Indian stuff happened down there, and you can call them Indians. I met lots of Indians, and they say, "You can call me an Indian." So all that Native American business and First Nations, you don't have to do that. So I'm just mentioning that in case anyone's shocked that I've said the word Indian.
And you, I mean, so the Old West, did you have a fascination then with, you know, the old silver screen, cowboys and Indians?
Yes.
Was there some...
Exactly. When I was a kid growing up in the sort of early 60s, really, I had comics and television, endless things. I had little guns of my own, and I used to watch TV while having dinner with guns beside my plate, so I could shoot at the outlaws. And my mum let me do that in order to get me to eat my dinner, you know. So I grew up with all that. But as I became an adult, I started to realise a lot of it's what was in the comics and the films and the TV is complete rubbish. Not complete rubbish, but almost complete. A lot of the people I thought were heroes, like Buffalo Bill, Kit Carson, if people know of him, they weren't really... They weren't black and white heroes at all. They did a few heroic things, but both those men were pretty awful in many ways. They both, at different times, were employed to kill Indians. Or to Kit Carson was employed, maybe I'm saying too much about this, by the US Army to conduct a scorched earth policy in order to get rid of the Navajo tribe. Luckily, he didn't succeed. But this man was presented to us as kids as a kind of role model. So anyway, I was trying to get to the bottom of things like that by driving down there.
Yeah.
Ed, let's talk about the genesis of your journey. I mean, this is a huge commitment to take on, to travel around the globe without flying. How did that come about?
There's a number of different reasons. I mean, one of the reasons I've been running an ethical and sustainability environmental communications agency, and I still have this kind of huge wanderlust and desire to travel, but felt a sort of slight tension, to say the least, in terms of the hypocrisy of wanting to go travelling, but then spending all of my professional career working on climate change, and therefore creating this vast planet-stewing slew of carbon emissions in my wake. I'd worked very intensively with my business partner for 7 years. I think we were getting the 7-year business itch. We weren't getting on very well. So it was actually partly about getting distance from that and creating the escape, but also having this appetite to go traveling, but what not wanting to have the kind of the contradiction of creating this massive carbon
impact. And how long did that take, and how far, what's the distance? Just to give everyone an idea of the scale of the journey.
So it was a 13-month, 381-day, 33 countries, 45,000 miles. And ironically, the carbon footprint of that journey is significantly less than if I'd stayed at home in the UK. So, you know, my advice, if you want to tackle climate change, is go travelling without flying, and your footprint will be smaller than staying at home.
We'll talk about that in a bit and the practicalities of everybody doing what you're doing. But just in terms of the cost of doing it, and how did you go about preparing to be able to just drop everything for 13 months? Was there a huge...
No, I think part of it actually is... Don't plan anything. And I say that slightly recklessly, but the only thing that I booked before I left the UK was the Trans-Siberian Express. And that's only because it gets so busy, you have to make sure you've got a place on the train.
Yeah.
Everything else was booked along the way. And I deliberately wanted it to be like that because I wanted it to unfold naturally rather than going... Okay, here is our schedule. You know, in August we must be in Malaysia, and there was a somewhat kind of dictated route by the cargo ships, because crossing the big blue wobbly bits is always a bit of a challenge when you're not going to get on a plane. But apart from that, most of it was done on the road, allowing for spontaneity, allowing for changes in direction, and allowing us to go a bit off the beaten track.
Fantastic. Tom, yours was another entirely different journey. I mean, it was travelling slowly, but around one area of the world. Again, how did that genesis... I mean, you're going to the honeymoon capital of the world, but it was shortly after a breakup from your relationship at that time.
Exactly.
So you did it on your own.
Well, anyway, I'd heard about a change in the rules in the Maldives. So this country is famous as being the honeymoon heaven and having these tourist islands. They're called the tourist islands. There are about 100 of them. But they have also islands that are called uninhabited islands. I'm sorry, inhabited islands, where the locals live. Mm. And so these were off out of bounds for visitors to the Maldives until 2009. And the rules changed in the country, and they allowed Westerners, outsiders, to visit these small islands, but nobody paid much attention to it. And I discovered that actually here was this place that everybody knows about. It's often on the front of the Condé Nast Traveler magazine as the ultimate place to go on for a beach holiday. But actually, there was a whole country that had been opened up to outsiders that nobody had explored. And so I went on cargo ships and local ferries and slowly went around. I mean, it's 600 miles from the top to the bottom. And places, that islands they hadn't seen an outsider for 20 years, or and really unexplored nation, really, that had opened up. And the reason they had the rule to prevent outsiders going was that because it's an Islamic country. And so in the 1980s, they were worried that the hippies on the hippie trail would kind of destroy, you know, bring in
the religion, yeah.
Coca-Cola and,
yeah.
and Budweiser and destroy these peaceful places, and a kind of a change in the politics of the country allowed this.
I mean, it's incredible that so many people visit the Maldives, and yet there are places in the Maldives that had very rarely seen a Western visitor. I mean, it really is quite incredible. Why is there a more relaxed, therefore, attitude to visitors? Is it about letting them benefit a bit more, the other islands to benefit from the tourism? What was the motivation behind opening that up? Was it
They've had a dictator in charge of the country for 30 years, and he stepped aside because of trouble. There was trouble in prison. There was a killing of an inmate by guards, and there was a great disruption to the politics of the country because of that. Also, there was a tsunami in 2004, and so they needed international aid, and international organizations were not keen on providing aid unless the politics was seen as transparent and above board. Mm. And so the dictator stepped aside, a democratic leader came in, but he introduced this policy to allow the smaller islands to benefit directly from tourism. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, he was ousted
was
in a coup.
Yeah.
And so now it's kind of back to how it was through unusual means.
But that doesn't mean that it's closed down the ability then to visit other areas. That policy has been retained.
So this policy is kept in place, right. Although the current government is not that keen on it. But what it means is that these little guest houses have opened up on these tiny islands where nobody's been to for, you know, no outsider has been to for centuries, really, apart from shipwrecked sailors. And it's just a very unusual, you don't get that often in the 21st century, that a whole country opens up because of a change of a rule.
Yeah. I think that idea of changing landscapes, I mean, with your journey, there's this timeless landscape of plains that you see, you know, the Great Plains and that scenery that's so familiar from the old Westerns. And yet, as a region, the change in recent history is enormous with, you know, the arrival of Europeans in the last...
Oh, yes.
And therefore, the impact that has really had on that area. It's an area that at one time seems timeless, another has seen such dramatic change.
I mean, yeah, that's right. Well, certainly of the people who live there, it's changed completely. I mean, up to, say, 200 years ago, or 150 even, most of the people who lived there were what I call, and quite rightly, Indians.
Yeah.
But now, they're confined... Well, those that are left are confined to very, very small reservations, always very remote, because of the whole process that went on of wiping them out, both with guns and disease. And the survivors made treaties that got broken, and they ended up anyway in tiny little, well, not that small, but remote reservations which you can visit and are quite interesting, but they don't have much chance there, really. The main thing they can make money out of is casinos, which is quite odd, but the reason for that is that they can make their own laws up to a point. So in a lot of those states, the gambling is illegal, but not on the Indian land. So they have casinos, they make quite a lot of money out of that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they can do a bit of ranching, but they can't farm because they don't have fertile enough land.
Because effectively they were left all the unfertile land.
Yeah, the small bits that the white people
let them have.
Didn't want. And it's terribly sad. Then the other things that have happened, you have fracking in North Dakota, which used to be the kind of very, very poor state and underpopulated. Now it's kind of, this is the western side of it. It's like kind of the gold rush. And they're worrying about things they used to worry about, again, 150 years ago, like say it's like Dodge City back then. There are, you know, saloons and gambling and prostitution and people killing each other for drug deals and all that. That's in North Dakota. Then further, Nebraska, I found, actually, was the most pristine. And you could imagine John Wayne, Gary Cooper, riding out of, you know, from 5 miles away towards you with a bit of dust around their horses. But then you, in Kansas is very flat and wheat-growing, but there are also what they call feedlots, which are these ghastly places that I don't think we have in England for fattening cattle. Mm-hmm. And they smell, and the cattle are treated appallingly, and they're fed this... They can't eat grass. They're only allowed to eat grass for about the first 8 months of their lives, and then they're taken to these places and fattened up for till they're about 18 months old, roughly. And so the landscape's scarred by that. Texas is a little bit scarred with oil again, but it's still very beautiful, actually. Mm-hmm,
But they're quite... I mean, the image that you would have of that region is of a deeply conservative, illiberal, rather backward area. Backward's the wrong word, but very, a very, very strictly conservative region.
Very
in the same way you might find with an Islamic state, in a different way.
Mostly
I wonder whether that impacted on the way you were treated in any ways, or whether you found
the people...
Well, the
people are
like
all
that.
Very friendly, and some of them are wonderfully liberal, actually. I think it's South Dakota, they have one Republican congressman and one Democrat. Mm-hmm. So it's not all mm-hmm. Republican rednecks. Mm-hmm. But, yes, I mean, you meet people who are friendly, and then you suddenly discover... Like, I spent a long time talking to a man in a shop who was giving me free gifts of stuff, and then he suddenly came out with the most appalling racist remarks that I did say them on radio earlier this week because I was encouraged to, but I don't really want to. It's just insulting to half of humanity, you know. Mm, mm. This guy who otherwise is very, very friendly. Mm, mm. And that happens quite a lot. Mm. They'll buy you drinks, and I was in a bar and there's guys saying, Tony Blair, you know, we love the English. And I thought, what? You know. But then a bit later he'll say something appalling about either black people or... That's another interesting thing, that all of these people, however right-wing, are sympathetic to the Indians. But, and I kept puzzling about that. Why are they racist, but they're sympathetic to the Indians? And eventually somebody gave me an answer. A rather nice young graduate student I met in a coffee bar in Abilene, Texas. And he said, it's because the Indians are no threat. There's so few of them. Everyone can say they had a rough time, which they did. They had more than a rough time. But black people and Hispanics are a threat, you know, mm-hmm. to some white people in America. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's a difference.
And that's it. But take your journey like that does allow you, and I would say this is one of the advantages of not flying, that you do actually get to see the good and bad of people, but you are engaging with people. I mean, is that one of the ways in which you would see an advantage of...
I think the whole point about the overland travel is, you know, you pass through the world rather than over it. And for me, the kind of the embodiment of the slow travel was the gradual transition of landscape, culture, people, language, cuisine, and you see the way that they all integrate together. And actually you realize that there's this incredible commonality of experience and aspiration wherever you go in the world. And I mean, for me, it's like the kind of the grounded equivalent of what astronauts experience when they go into space. And, you know, there's this documented idea of the overview effect, that when these hard-bitten former military test pilots sit in their little space capsule looking down at the planet, they see interconnectedness, interdependence, the kind of the politics and all the kind of the petty differences seem ridiculous, you know, and they have these epiphanies. And, you know, again, they're former hard-bitten military test pilots come down you know, with slight sort of hippie glow.
Yeah.
And you kind of get that too when you travel through the world. You know, yeah. You really do feel this deep connection with people and landscape. And I talk about it as when you've gone and done that circumnavigation, you end up with this continuous mental visual imagery of the whole journey. You know, it's not flying up to 35,000 feet and bunny hopping around in an aluminium sausage. It's really there. I can recreate every aspect of that journey and in different parts of the world, and a mental image pops into my head. But it really does make you realise that, you know, without being too philosophical about it, that, you know, we're all one. And, you know, that's one magical thing that slow overland travel really does emphasise.
The unmagical side, presumably, is that you are having to go through customs points or other bureaucratic red tape stuff that you would just be flying straight over if you were flying. I mean, were there difficulties associated with that side of things?
Yes, mainly due to my own stupidity. Obviously one of the consequences of having to cross, if you do 33 countries, you're crossing dozens of different borders. You have to make damn sure you've got your paperwork in order. I had to do a massive last-minute bypass around Belarus when I was trying to get from Warsaw to Moscow because my scant knowledge of European politics had meant I'd forgotten that Belarus was in the way and I didn't have a transit visa. Got pulled off the train on the Mongolian border in China because my Chinese visa had expired 3 days beforehand. I hadn't noticed. So kind of this very, very polite Chinese border guard said, "And now for formalities," which basically meant being carted off at gunpoint. But the best one was actually going into Japan, where I'd taken a ferry from China to Japan, and I was the only Westerner on the ferry. And the customs officers pulled me to one side, saying, OK, this is a great chance to practice our English. And they were going through my bag, and they pulled out this very dodgy packet of Vietnamese rolling tobacco. And the guy sort of opened it up and very excitedly went, "Marijuana." And I went, no, it's tobacco. And he went, no, marijuana. And I said, no, it's tobacco. Anyway, this kind of negotiation, he starts testing it. And about a week beforehand in China, I'd gone to where the Great Wall of China meets the sea, this lovely little place called Shanhai Guan. And at the base of the Great Wall was this enormous patch of ganja. And of course, I had my photo taken in the middle of this field of cannabis. And so the second Japanese customs officer is flicking through my digital camera at this point and comes across this shot of me in the middle of the ganja batch gang. And he sort of taps me on the shoulder and goes, "Marijuana?" And I was like, "Yes, that is marijuana." And he goes, "Where is this?" I said, "It's in China." I said it was a week ago, you know, I didn't pick any. And he goes, "You smoke marijuana?" And I sort of rather naively went, "Yes, I've smoked marijuana." And he went, "When you smoke marijuana?" I said, "About 3 months ago." He said, "Where you smoke marijuana?" I said, "Amsterdam." And both he and his colleague went, "Oh, Amsterdam." As if to say, you know, if we were in Amsterdam, we'd smoke marijuana. And they let me in. So.
You presumably had, you know, in a different way, I don't know how it works with setting up trips where you are literally getting cargo ships and just the practicalities of arranging to board these things, is that something that, or is part of your slow travel just hanging around for a long time, having to wait for things to happen?
Well, there was a lot of hanging around. There was certainly no marijuana in the Maldives. It's an Islamic state. They don't allow booze on the kind of islands that are not the tourist islands. But what got me, I suppose it was slow travel and that I was going completely off the beaten track of nobody really done what I had done before. And yes, I cut it out of the book, but there was a lot of waiting by the docks, which is not interesting to read about. But I, bit by bit, I got kind of better. You know, a captain would tell you, go to this boat, and then you'd go to the docks, and eventually the boat would leave. It was a completely different, it was so off the beaten track that nobody had done it before. No. And
how do people react, you know, when you were saying to them, "Can I get on this boat?" Was it the fact you were writing about it that opened doors and allowed you to do it? Could anyone do what you did?
Anybody could do it.
Yeah.
And it's like kind of a new version of Greek island hopping in a way that I think it will become popular.
Yeah.
So, because the Maldives honestly is the most beautiful place. It's all these very flat islands and it's a threat from the rising sea. It could be the first nation to be evacuated if climate change does happen. 80% of the land is 1 meter above water level, and by the end of the century, scientists predict that at least 50 centimeters of water rising will happen. That's a conservative estimate. When you look at it, you have these very low-level islands with palm trees and white sand beach. It is paradise, and that's why it's on the front of Condé Nast Traveler so often, and that's why it's the honeymoon heaven. And what's extraordinary is that you can, for a cheap flight, the price of getting to Orlando, fly out to the Maldives and start jumping on ferries, and nobody really realizes that. And now that they've got these new guest houses, so I see it as being a potentially big development in travel. You know, I've worked on the Times for almost 20 years, and I haven't seen anything like this ever happen before.
No,
I do see it as being realistic that people can follow in the footsteps. And also, I can't tell you how wonderful it was just stepping off the, getting away from the tube, getting away from the treadmill of work, and suddenly, I mean, you're talking about slow travel. I mean, Ed is the master of slow travel, having gone around the world without any planes. But it felt as though I'd stepped off the edge of the internet. I didn't take the smartphone with me. I traveled from island to island, and often sleeping in the people's spare rooms, or I didn't know where I was going to go, and it was a real adventure that was possible in the 21st century. Not, people say, okay, the Google has covered the world, there is nowhere left to explore, but that's rubbish. Here's a place that's on the front of all these major magazines, and yet there were all these islands to explore.
How aware are the locals of the fact that their home is so under threat from global warming? Are the inhabited islands, some of them unaware of that threat, or is it something that's very much to the forefront?
It's 50-50. So the population of the Maldives, 350,000, is the size of the Croydon in terms of population. It's small. And yes, many people were very aware of the issues, and many others were saying, well, look, why are all these international holiday hotel companies investing in our islands if we're really going to sink? So there was kind of, some people believed it, some people didn't, and there was kind of a 50-50 kind of attitude towards that. And it's kind of burying their heads in the sand a little bit, but there's a great awareness amongst, I would say, 50% of the population that this country might have to be evacuated, which is no laughing matter at all. And I kind of regard the Maldives as almost being symbolic in some way of the climate change dilemma that we face, rather like the polar bear.
It's a similar... I mean, of course, the US, in terms of pollution, is one of the guilty parties. You did your trip in a fairly economical car, didn't you?
Yes.
The Prius, which is...
yes.
Are you sponsored by the Toyota Prius?
No. I wish... no, they should... they should make something out of it, because... well, partly because I keep talking about how great their car is, which I'd never driven before. I don't know whether anyone here has got a Toyota Prius, but I rented it, and I found you don't turn it on like a normal car. You don't start it. You push a button, and nothing... it switches on, like, say, a television. And then you put your foot down slightly, and it starts to move, and there's no noise. Very weird. But you get used to it, and it's a great car. It doesn't use much petrol. And then it has this other advantage I discovered for writers, which is why I think Toyota should sponsor writers or have a prize. They could even... I'll tell you what this is. I don't think I've told you. On the back of a Toyota Prius, I don't know whether anyone has one or can visualize it, the back window slopes very, very gradually, and then there's a little plastic shelf sticking out. And I at the beginning of my journey, in the colder climes up north, I used to sit in the car a lot, writing in my notebook. And then when I got down, I suppose, to Kansas, it got hotter and hotter, and I couldn't just sit there. It was boiling in the car. So I got out and thought, well, what can I do? And it's just the right height, this shelf. that sticks out the back. I think maybe someone like Jeremy Clarkson might think it's a spoiler. Is that the word? As a slow traveller, I don't know about these things, but I think it's meant to make the car go faster, actually, this sort of piece of plastic. But it's just the right height for you to stand up. I'll just do that and write like this. So I really recommend it. And they could make a lot out of that. You know, they could have the Toyota Salman Rushdie or something, you know. It's funny, but it actually was really useful. Because where else, you know, you want to write something and you're stuck by the side of a road and it's boiling hot. And there's this nice little shelf to stand up. Anyway.
You obviously didn't have your Toyota Prius. But every other way of travelling is. Is travelling by air always bad?
Well, no, I think you'd be daft to say that. I mean, for me, the carbon emissions and the personal impact it has on your carbon footprint are quite problematic. But, you know, that's because I'm a slightly obsessive, geeky environmentalist, you know. For me, it's really about what you miss out on when you fly. And certainly within Europe, you know, we have pretty much anywhere. You can get anywhere in Europe in 24 hours by train. So there's no real excuse. There's some, obviously, tensions around pricing. But there's no tax on aviation fuel, so we're not working on a level playing field. Basically, we are essentially subsidising cheap aviation at the moment at the cost of trains. But equally, once you cross the channel, you're joined to the whole continent as far as Vladivostok and Beijing. So, you know, you've got this vast adventure you can have without going anywhere near a plane, if you so choose. So for me, it's not about being anti-flying. It's actually about saying, you know, flying is the wham, bam, thank you, ma'am of travel, you know, whereas overland travel is a bit more of the slow seduction. It's a bit more satisfying. I mean, I use a fast food metaphor a lot. Is that saying you can go and ram a burger down your throat, you know, and that's nice every now and again, but you don't want to live like that all the time. Whereas there's something incredibly rewarding about the home-cooked meal where you select the ingredients yourself and it's crafted with a bit of love and shared with friends. And I think, for me, that's what slow travel is all about. It's about travel, not just transit. And increasingly, we're trying to commoditize travel. I mean, I'm saying this in the destinations show. The commoditization of travel is a huge problem. It's always about... It's turning us into another form of consumption. It's like, I want that experience. I want to buy that off the shelf. You know, I want to have this. And actual fact, I think it should be a little bit more organic and dirty and complicated.
Is there not a danger, though, that if you argue that, and this, I'm not saying that you specifically, but there is certainly a movement towards staycationing, you know, domestic tourism. I mean, we've got books on travel in the UK. Or, as you've said, the relative ease with which you can travel across Europe without flying, that actually some of the poorest nations on the planet, those that will most benefit from tourism and need Western money, will in effect get isolated, get cut off from that. And you're almost creating a barrier and increasing disparity between wealth in a way. I can absolutely see the advantage of slow travel in terms of carbon footprint. I can see the negatives in terms of cultural expansion, in terms of spreading of wealth.
It's a fair point. I mean, I don't think, as I say, I'm not talking about banning flying. Mm. The bigger argument there, I think, is less about aviation and more about the real inclusive, sustainable impact of tourism on communities. Yeah. You know, 20 years ago, I worked in Jamaica as a volunteer teacher, and the model of tourism there was despicable because it was so exclusive. It was so chain-link fences around the resorts. You know, most local people had very little share or interest in the revenues that were coming into that country. Mm. It was all a kind of corralled and coordinated to a moneyed few. And, you know, and to some extent, I'm sure Tom agrees that, you know, that still happens in the Maldives where, you know, that whilst there's big revenues coming in and there's jobs, you know, the control of that industry is still not with the people. And so I think it's a real double-edged sword. So we could talk about aviation, but actually it's real organic, sustainable, community-led, almost like a fair trade form of tourism on the ground, which is probably more important.
Yeah, okay. And actually, just, I mean, Ed mentioned it there, the disparity in well, I mean, the Maldives has got to be one of the biggest, visible disparities in wealth.
Well,
the richest people in the world going there and some of the poorest.
Things I talk about in the book, but the average Maldivian salary compared to what people are spending in these resorts, I mean, the resorts are $5,000 a night, or yeah. Some of the suites, and it was estimated, it was worked out that the Beckhams stayed at this wonderful resort, and they spent £6 a minute while they were there, and this is just grotesque, really, compared to the earnings of the local people, and that kind of whole them and us of the world that everyone's been talking about more and more in recent years about the inequality, global inequality, was kind of focused into this honeymoon hotspot, and it was interesting to kind of see it close up, and also, you know, I was staying in £10 a night guest houses, or, you know, very, very cheap, sleeping on a cargo ship floor for, you know, with three curry meals a day thrown in for £7 or something. I was traveling so cheaply around this paradise, but and seeing the kind of, and I gate crashed a couple of the hotels on one occasion to see the other side of life, but tourism, when you see it in these stark terms, and all the way around the world now, you know, we go to places and we stay in very expensive hotels, or people who can afford it do. And yet the average income of the locals is so much lower. Mm. So, but when you're talking about tourism in general, I think you can't say no to flying, and to tourism, which, you know, is impossible because tourism is so important to the world economy. So if you, and to Britain's economy as well, I'd say. So whether it's very, it'd be impossible just to say, oh, right, no, this is horrible, everyone jumping on flights and ruining the world. But if you took away these flights, the economy of the world would collapse, in my opinion. Mm. So we've got to be realistic about it.
And, I mean, the slow travelling, the way you've just described it, is you may have flown there, but you were then very much giving money direct to the small hotel and guest house owners, you know, looking beyond the big international...
Yeah, well, the big corporations, these multinational companies running many of the hotels in the Maldives, the money's going straight into there. They don't pay tax on it because there's a dodgy kind of relationship with the government, and the money goes straight to Singapore into private bank accounts, and the locals don't see any of it.
I just want to open it up to see if anybody's got any questions themselves to David, Ed, or Tom. You may or may not have, if you haven't. Oh, there's one here. There's Zoe's got a microphone, I think.
Okay. We've enjoyed three very interesting, engaging speakers, but I noticed that you haven't got any women up here. So I just wonder how the experience would be, a slow travel for a woman doing each of these journeys. You know, the idea of a woman on the floor of this cargo ship, for example. You know.
Well, first of all, Ed travelled with his wife.
I travelled with my partner at the time. So, you know, she and I did the whole journey together. And so, yeah, it was a fairly unique experience. I mean, we were actually joking about this in the green room before we came on. It was like saying, so clearly slow travel is only for middle-aged white men, which is obviously not the case. And actually, there are some great people out there, which we'll make sure get on the panel next year. I mean, Ant Bolingbroke-Kent is one of the women I think is really inspiring. She did a motorcycle journey down the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam. And, you know, so there are some great people out there. But blame Stanford.
Well, I would say Hilary Bratt, the owner of Bratt Guides. I mean, she is the classic female slow traveller who, I mean, she still hitchhikes everywhere. She opened up the Inca Trail. So I think there are those role models, and certainly Hilary has spoken during this show. So, as you say, blame Stanford's, but they have had other ones.
But you could go to do what I did as a female. I mean, there were women I met at the different guest houses, and they, so it's possible to do it. You perhaps wouldn't want to go on the roughest of the cargo ships, but there's a way, because it's not very comfortable, to be perfectly honest, but it was exhilarating and interesting doing it. Yeah. And only a couple of nights I spent really on the roughest of cargo ships, but you could really have an adventure at male or female doing what I did.
And it depends how you behave on the cargo ships. We had one, obviously, when you're hanging out with the crew, that's the only entertainment, and a lot of the merchant seamen are Filipino, so you end up singing a lot of karaoke, and my girlfriend at the time decided to sing Madonna's Like a Virgin to a room full of Filipino seamen who'd been at sea for 3 months. Not a good idea.
And you'd have no problem driving down Highway 83 and staying in the motels I stayed in. And I did meet a woman who owned and ran a ranch. And, you know, that's, it's not just men down there with Stetsons and stuff. So there's a lot going on for both genders. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Does anybody else have
any more questions?
A question? No?
I've got a question for Ed. Did you get seasick?
No.
You didn't,
luckily.
You were lucky.
No, actually, the cargo ships were the least... I mean, I think we had about 45 days at sea in total. And the cargo ships, mercifully, the crossings of the Pacific and the Atlantic and the Tasman were all relatively calm. The worst bit was actually going on the ferry from Portsmouth to Bilbao right at the start of the journey, where we got caught in an enormous storm in the Bay of Biscay and had 72 hours... tossing on 25-foot waves, and that was horrific. I still didn't get seasick, but everyone else was. So, you know, the kind of... The
still
ship was
bad.
Awash with vomit.
Nice.
And even the captain kept coming on the tannoy and saying, it's just like to reassure everyone, it's a good ship, it's a strong ship. It's like, he's trying to convince himself.
That's brilliant. And can I ask each of you, what is your favourite way to travel? Is it train, bus, car, boat? What's your favourite?
I like going by train.
You're a train man.
Yeah, I like looking out the window. Yeah.
How about you, Ed?
Yeah, it's got to be trains.
Train.
There's something about the gentle rolling rhythm and the kind of the landscape going past the window. It's like your sort of personal TV show. It's much better than watching the screen in the back of the seat in front.
Yeah. How about you, David?
I've got to say the Toyota Prius.
You're trying to get sponsorship. He's trying to get sponsorship, isn't he?
I can take it, you know, anywhere I want. Whereas
true.
I love trains too. And I like walking. Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Adrian? What do you like?
I prefer trains probably out of any. Yeah. I would say. I'm not somebody who would close my mind to plane travel. Although I don't enjoy the experience a great deal. I do think that there is an argument saying that if you really want to explore someone in depth and it's not close to you, you've got to get there relatively quickly to give yourself the time there. And so I've always argued that point. But I certainly agree that it's the least enjoyable form of travel. I mean, you do get a great viewpoint from up in the sky. I mean, you can get some... It's actually quite lovely to look down from above and get that sort of perspective. But there's nothing better than a rail journey, I personally think.
This is the irony, because everyone assumes that I am terrified or hate flying. Actually, I secretly love flying. I just don't allow myself the indulgence.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, Tom, your first book was about travelling... on all the budget airlines all around the place.
Places you can't spell or pronounce in Eastern Europe when Ryanair really was one pence each way. I very much enjoyed that experience, but also it was kind of a moment in... It changed travel, the low-cost airlines, that whole phenomenon, and they challenged British Airways and Air France and Lufthansa and to cut back their fares. And so ever since then, really, since the mid-90s, I'd say, travel has become much cheaper to fly, to get around the world. And it's become kind of more normal to zip off to Asia.
I mean, that democratization of travel is one of the big movements of the last 50 years or whatever. I mean,
absolutely.
It is incredible, the cultural change that has offered, the way that it has allowed people to open up their horizons.
Which is the opposite of slow travel.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. And that's where this tension comes, I think.
But, Tom, you said something earlier that you could fly to the Maldives cheaper than flying to Florida.
Flight to the Maldives costs £650 return, which is about the same, I think, as going to America return.
Yeah.
And that was with first choice... charter, flight, whatever, direct. Sure. It's almost ludicrous how cheap it is when you take away the taxes and you look at how far per mile, how many pence you spend. This has all really happened in the last 20 years. So this kind of discussion about slow travel is a reaction, I think, to what has been going on because of these cheap flying, cheap fares.
I think that's our end, isn't it? We have to finish.
I think that's ended beautifully. Basically, what you're saying, guys, is get out there. Get out there and not just fly, isn't it? Go on an adventure. Find a new way of getting to your destination, basically, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Cheshire. We have Ed Gillespie, David Reynolds and Adrian Phillips. Let's give them a big round of applause.
Thank you, everybody.
We'll be blogging and posting recordings of all the events live each day, so check back for more.